We're continuing our interview with Patrick Rankin. It is still October 27th, 2005. So continuing on, the question before our previous tape ended was, when you went to Eastern for that one term, were you on track to become a teacher at that time?
No, I really was not. Lots of schools besides Eastern would accept a junior college, all the credit that you earn from a junior college, and it was considered also to be a junior college, a two-year. And that was my, before I even started the first term at Eastern, I knew that it was going to be for only 2 years. However, I, in the back of my head, and also in choosing the courses that I took that first term, I was going to enter a school of engineering at Oregon State. That's what I figured I would do after 2 years. So in other words, I was going to take the essentials, up here, and then transfer to Oregon State to finish.
To complete the major. This was your original plan then?
That was my original plan.
Okay. Then you got drafted.
Yeah. Actually, I did not get drafted.
Were you a volunteer?
Well, I did get drafted. I don't know if you even want me to waste time talking about that.
It happened here in Union County, didn't it?
Well, let's hear it then.
How'd you get drafted?
Okay, on October the 20th, I was 18 years old. Classified 4S or something, I think, because I was a student. The day I became 18, I was notified 2 days later by the draft board that I was 4A and eligible for conscription, the draft. And about a week later, I was on a train with several other guys headed to Portland, where I took a physical, pretty old physical exam for induction. And I passed that, and they sent me back home, and but with the notice that they did not know exactly when the day that I would be drafted, but that I would be receiving soon the Dear John greetings. And I forgot the day that I got the greetings, but it was like the very last of part of November, and I had the greetings for the 11th day of December to report to Portland. And I went down one day early and enlisted in the regular army.
By doing that, did that give you a choice in the matter?
No.
Otherwise, would they have picked the service that you were going to be in?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Yep, they would have.
Yep.
Plus, there was another, I had another reason too.
Okay.
If I joined the regular army, I could not only pick the service within limits that I could go into, but I would be under a 18-month enlistment, which was a brand new thing that had just happened a month before. Anyone who had been in the Army draftee, who was a draftee, since about 10th Earl Harder. The only way they could get out was on points. You had to have so many points to get out. And, of course, time and service was one way you accumulated points. And if you were in a combat zone, or in combat, you accumulated a few more points than if you were not. And so most of those guys that were getting out had an accumulated time of, on average, about 4 years that they had been in there. Some of them had been in there for about 5.5 years.
Before they had to, you mean they were, in other words, they were kind of stuck there because they had to accumulate these points to get out.
That's the only way.
Okay.
That's the only way.
And when you enlisted in this 18-month deal, that was completely different from the point system?
Yes, it was, because it named, 18 months later, I was eligible for a honorable discharge. About the only strength on it was what they call that honorable service. You could be in the brig and get out with an honorable discharge.
Oh, yeah. You still had to be good.
That's right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So you knew about this before you went to take that physical exam?
Before I enlisted.
So you knew about this new program? How did you learn about it?
I'm not sure that I knew about it before I took that physical, but I did find out about it by the time I got the greetings.
Okay.
I knew I had that option.
So between the time you took the physical and the time you got the letter inviting you to participate, you found out about this new program. If you had just taken the draft notice and gone in, you would have been stuck on this point system with everyone else to get out?
Yeah. Okay. By the way the law read at that time, just kind of on a round number basis, that this is not true, probably not true for all the other facilities in the United States, but I was inducted in Fort Lewis, and we went into a War Department Separation Center, and there were, on average, there were 3,000 of us in that separation center, and but there were about 110 were new enlistees. The rest of them were men who had been in there and were getting out on points. It took them 3 days to go through that separation center, and we were both billeted right together.
How long did you ultimately serve?
About a year and a half.
That 18 months,
yep.
Then, and you got out back, yep, basically right on time.
I did.
Who? Go ahead.
I served with a fellow. He was one of my roommates in a barracks. He thought about doing the same thing. He was from California, and he decided, the heck with that 18-month thing. He said, I'm going to take my chances. So he and there was more than him, too. He let him draft him. And maybe about a year, less than a year, they changed the law again where they would consider attorney the draftees loose after 12 months service. By the time his 12 months came along, They let him out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, you know, the only thing they needed was Korea and Japan and Germany occupation forces. And in fact, that's what I did, was train occupation forces for Korea. And
did you serve overseas?
No.
Okay.
The whole outfit that I went through basic with, all but two of us. One of us was the guy who got out in 12 months. Oh. Found out when we got back from leave that they were all going to Korea, except me and Barry. And we didn't know. Well, it was like a couple days later that we found out, finally, that we were going to stay right in the basic training company as cantrymen. And, I tell you.
So you didn't even get to go anywhere then?
No, I didn't get to go anywhere, and I had to go through that basic training. They made me a platoon sergeant, and I got third platoon. And I went through three more of those basic training cycles. And then they kind of did me a favor, but it was really no favor. They had these training inspectors, and they were all out of regiment headquarters. They didn't stay in the companies at all. So I went up to this regimental headquarters, me and one other guy, and then we go around over all the battalions and check on the way they were conducting these basic training classes and the physical side of it, and of course if they were following up, why, we had to write them up. Or turn them all the way up to a regiment, then it filtered down. Somebody got lined up for it. They, you know, straightened out the whatever was missing. Mm-hmm.
Who else do you know that went into the service with you from La Grande or Union County? Did you know anyone else? Did anyone go with you at that time?
Yes, they did, but I did not know them.
Okay.
There were three other guys, and they did not end up at, they ended up at Fort Lewis, all right, but then they left Fort Lewis and went to, I don't know where.
Okay, but you didn't know them personally then, just the three others went with you around the same time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I did run on to a couple guys I knew from the Grand, but they were, they both were guys who went in after, right after I did, like 2-3 months after.
Who were they?
One of them's name was Loveless.
So you knew who they were, but they weren't friends or associates of yours?
I knew the, I can't think of Lovis's first name.
That's okay.
But I went to school with him. He was in my high school class, but I didn't know him very well.
Okay, so you got back out. You lived in Washington for a time. When did you come back to La Grande?
1960.
And what did you do then? What was your main occupation at first?
Okay, listening out.
We gotta back up.
Yeah.
Where did you meet your wife?
I met her right here. We went on a double date, all arranged by Willie Hammond, and it was Delpha Moorhead, Willie's eventual wife. Charlotte was, let's see now, she had gone one term at Oregon.
You mean University of Oregon,
yeah,
when you say that?
Yeah, she had gone two terms at Eastern. I think it was one term. No, I mean 1 year at Eastern. And was here for the summer like I was. I met her. That fall, she went to Oregon, and I went back to Oregon State.
So you're talking University of Oregon she went
yes.
to?
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, at Eugene.
Right.
Yeah. And we only dated like two or three times before school started in September. And then we kind of all put it together that we would try to get together down there. And it was, of course, it was only about 50 miles apart. And I had relatives in Eugene who lived in Eugene. And I would go down there once in a while to see them. But right away, I went down there to see Charlotte, and first thing you know, it was, that year, I think she came home some other way, but I took her back down to Oregon. Then in 1950, New Year's Eve, 1950, Charlotte and I, we were engaged the summer before, and then we were married December 31st, 1950.
Where?
Right here in the Grand. We got married in Charlotte's folks' home. We did get married in a church. She was a regular member of the Presbyterian Church, and it was her pastor who married us.
Where did Charlotte's parents live?
They lived in La Grande. They had been here since 1944, Carl owned and operated a cream collecting station. He'd buy cream from farmers all over Union Wallawa and Baker County, test it for butterfat, pay them for the total pounds of cream. Then he would reship it, or he would package it and ship it to usually another creamery in Portland, where most of it would go into making butter or cheese. And he operated that for another darn near 20 years after we were married.
So you got married on New Year's Eve of 1950. Were you both still in college?
We were. However, we came back and moved to the family. My family owned this ranch up the river. And And that fall, the fall of 1950, the Army threatened to get me back in there because even though I had not served, I had not joined the active reserve, the threat was North Korea, and of course the war started right there at that time, and they were really short on training cadre for combat engineers, and that's what I have done for bridge companies.
Yeah.
And they wrote me a letter that fall term while I was down there and told me to get my things in order, that maybe by the end of that term I was going to be on active duty. I could get out of it then by claiming a 4F for farming for my dad, because he really did want to retire. And so we came home, and we made it 2 years before we started school again. And I never went back into the Army.
So, did you get that 4F status? Getting married didn't have anything to do with it.
No. It didn't.
Did you have to file?
It used to be that you did, if you were married, you did get a different status on life. Mm-hmm. Which didn't do you any good in the early 40s.
Okay.
You'd be married, you were still in there.
Right. So, did you have to file paperwork with Selective Service here in Union County to establish that you were needed to help with the farm?
I let them know that that's what I was going to do. And the board, the local board. And so they gave it up. They could see they were going to have to cut it, so they
went on to easier bait.
I think that's probably just
some
other poor, either that or they made do with what they had, or I don't know.
Okay.
But the Army really increased them. You know, they had come to the Army to bear whatever. They discharged, what, they had about 16 million in the armed forces in 1945, and they have that reduced down to about 2 million in a pretty short period of time.
So when the next conflict came up, they were kind of caught short in terms of what their needs were.
When the North Koreans invaded the communists.
Okay, so it was 2 more years before you got back to college. You eventually completed a degree, and a bachelor's degree in agriculture?
Right.
Was it?
Yes, it was.
Was it a general degree?
1954.
Uh-huh.
And Charlotte was with me all the way through the last part of it. I lacked 4 terms of being able to graduate, and she was with me. And Charmarie, our oldest girl, and Paul, our oldest boy, were right down there. Paul was born right in the summer session between Oregon State spring and fall session.
Did your wife graduate from Oregon State also?
No, she did not go to Oregon State, and she did not go back to University of Oregon. However, in 1970, Mama?
What?
1970 or 72? You graduated?
1970.
Yep,
yep. Old lady of Oregon.
Yep. She got a teaching degree from Eastern. Yep. And got her certificate. Yep.
Where did she teach?
Her first job was at Elgin. She was a good teacher. A good teacher. But she had a problem with it. She just couldn't leave it up there. When she come home at night, she bring that job home with her. And by the time her 3-year contract was up, well, she was just, she wasn't a wreck, but I wanted to quit. Our kids the youngest one was in high school before she ever started getting the degree to begin with. In fact, she went to Eastern at the same time that our oldest girl, Charlie Reed, went up there.
Oh.
Mama and daughter up there at Eastern. She signed up as a substitute teacher in several districts, mostly right here in the Grand District, and it wasn't but probably after even the first year, they just gave her all the teaching she wanted, all the substitute teaching she wanted, and that really worked out well. For her, and I'm sure for them too.
So she didn't go back to a regular classroom after that?
No, she didn't.
She stayed on the substitute list?
Yep.
Well, that works for a lot of people. We're going to run out of tape again soon. So you came back to Le Grand. Did you say that you briefly worked for the power company?
Yeah.
Was that the first thing you did when you returned to Le Grand in
the
60s?
Uh-huh. I finished my coursework in December. And I already had a job with Washington State College, but it was not going to start until July. I wanted a job because we needed money.
Yeah.
And but we came back and we lived right here in this house. Where were Mom and Dad?
At the ranch, of course.
Yeah. And,
we were trying to pin down the power company job.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. They needed a meter reader.
Mm.
And Elmer Miller taught me all the routes. It was everything except the rural. And I read meters until about the last of June. And then we reported to Pullman first and then Ephrata. We moved up to Ephrata.
Now, what was the name of the power company at that time?
Yeah, it was Eastern Oregon Light and Power, Eastern Oregon Electric.
Got that.
Okay.
It might have been California Pacific, but I think that's in that, in those years, I think it's when they became California Pacific, a name change thing only.
So then you went to Washington State, and then when did you come back to La Grande again?
In 1960.
And what did you
March.
Do? What did you do when you...
Back here, get moved right here into this house and started farming right here and running that ranch up there.
Well, now the other ranch that you're talking about, where is that located?
It's located on Jordan Creek, about a mile and a half south of the gun club, rifle range.
Okay.
Up Highway 244 toward Ukiah.
How big is that place?
Well, at that time we had about.
It is still October 27th. We continue with the Patrick Rankin interview. You're telling me about how big the ranch was at the time.
It was 1,280 acres.
What's
Jordan.
And what's the current size of that ranch now?
Well, we sold some of it. Sold that. It is now actually our granddaughter and her uncle own 480 acres of it. And then we've still got the rest of it.
About 800 and some?
Yeah.
What do you grow there? What does the ranch do or produce?
Well, alfalfa. Alfalfa, grass, mixture. There's timber on it. And native grasses.
And how long has that ranch been in your family? Your parents had that ranch too? Did your parents have that ranch too?
Yep. My grandfather and my grandfather acquired it. And then that's my dad's dad. He acquired it from the homestead. That is part of it. He acquired from the homesteader itself. Then two uncles acquired the rest of it. But eventually it all ended up in one uncle owned it. And then, when that uncle died, he gave it to my dad.
This was your dad's brother?
Yeah.
And so then it's been in your particular line of the family ever since?
Yeah.
The
house was built. The house was finished in 1917. Actually, it's a good old house. And, we've done a lot of work on it. And our youngest girl, Kay, lived there. And actually, pretty well raised both of her children there. Until it's been 4 years since she moved to the Willamette Valley to stay while her husband went to work down there. that was sort of the headquarters down there. So it was either a lot of traveling for him or traveling for her.
I see. So when you came home to help or take over the work of the farm, that included the ranch as well as this main place?
Yeah.
Because that sounds like the main place to me, and this is the smaller end, but which one was more work? Of course, he did have the hogs here, so...
Yeah, but there was more time required up there because we raised hay on about 120 acres of that, and then there was a lot of fence to take care of, and also feeding the cattle, always fed them up there, never did bring the cattle down here to feed them. Lots better feeding conditions up there than down here.
Now, how did a person manage a farm at that time? I imagine it's different today than it was then. Tell me a little bit about doing that. How do you plan to manage a farm?
Well,
there must have been a routine.
Oh, yeah, there was a routine, all dictated by the season of the year. Of course, you always had the deadlines because of the seasons. And in those days, it didn't take like nearly as many acres or nearly as many cattle or nearly as many hogs to make a comfortable living for a family or to sustain a business. And that's really what got us you have to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and they're still going in order just to stay in business. And of course, there's a lot of economic reasons why that it has turned out that way. We, in 1973, in addition to this place and that ranch, I leased a 900-acre place that was in three different locations, really, out here in the valley. And 580 acres of that was irrigated. And with help, I operated that in addition to these with machinery. Without machinery to do it, I couldn't do it. One person couldn't do it, couldn't manage it.
You seem to have done well enough to have raised and provided for your family.
As far as I'm concerned, we have always had just a comfortable living. We sure never got rich at it. In the 1970s, we really, like all the rest of the farmers, had three bad crop years in a row. And that really, we wouldn't still be at it. I'm too old for that, but I would have stuck with that operation a lot longer if it hadn't been for those particular 3 years. They cost so much money that I just gave up trying to keep it dig out. Couldn't dig out. We had a bad freeze in the 28th of June, 1975.
Was that the first year? The first of the three bad years?
That was the third year. After I started it. Yeah. And some parts of it was a total loss. Never got any return. And Some of it, like, there was further, like, right here. I had some of this in wheat. And that wheat was about an 80% crop of what it should have been. Back then, there were several hundred acres of it out there that didn't get anything out of it. And it was a beautiful crop. It was irrigated wheat. I had a lot of money at it, and I didn't get anything out of it. That was also leased. All of that was leased. And of course,
so you couldn't pay the lease then.
It was a sharecropper, and so the landlord didn't make anything, and we didn't either.
I have some land like that on the reservation.
Is that right?
Wheat. Yeah. So I'm familiar a little bit with the share, with the shared lease business.
You guys have never had an actual crop failure on that reservation, have you? Well, you might have had a dry year or two.
Several dry years, but I don't know about a failure. Or at least I haven't heard of one. And I'm not long-term familiar with this because I only picked up this land a few years ago, but I'd say it's been pretty popular because it's farming was the main enterprise on the reservation before we had gaming and, you know, other things come in there. So that was really farming and fishing were top of the list. Well, let's talk about these seasons. You said a lot of what you did around the year were dictated by the seasons. So let's talk about where do you begin on the seasons? Let's start with the fall. What happens in the fall? What's dictated on your...
Well, fall is always seeding time. Now, there's exceptions to that too, but winter wheat, of course. September, if you've got the moisture. October, probably if you don't have...
Is when you plant seeds?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. For winter wheat. That's the only thing. In the fall, that on this leased land, I grew potatoes and grass seed, fescues and bluegrass seed, wheat. That was it.
Would you reseed those crops in the fall as well?
Nothing but the grains.
Okay.
Were reseeded all. Yeah, in the fall. Potatoes, of course, was in the spring.
Okay. What do you do in the winter?
I fed cattle. And that's how I utilize my winter time was feeding cattle and, you know, taking care of them.
But with the crops, there's very little or nothing to do during that time frame?
Not in the winter time.
Okay.
Work on machinery. Maintain machinery.
Okay. What do you do in the spring?
Well, that could be seeding time too, again. If alfalfa is always seeded in the spring. Spring wheat or spring barley. We grow a little bit of winter barley, but not all that much. And we never did grow a lot of spring barley either. Just make it off of that.
But major planting goes on in the spring.
Like alfalfa, right. And the potatoes, that was always in the spring. If we were starting a new seed variety, that was spring seeded but then that would be him for at least 3 years after that initial crop year, that seeding year.
How about the summer?
Well, harvest would begin with alfalfa in probably the early part of June, and that would last, well, we always would get 3 cuttings out right here or out in the valley, or 1 cutting up at the ranch. It wouldn't recover, and it was always later up there too. Like, we wouldn't cut that until about 1st of July.
Now, when you talk about cutting, you do 3 cuttings here. That means after you've cut it the first time, it will grow again. You can cut it again, and it will grow again. You could get 3 cuttings. Okay. All right. But only 1 up at the ranch. What else in the summer? That's alfalfa.
Okay. Alfalfa. Then wheat harvest. Grass seed harvest. Potato harvest. It was always a russet Burbank potatoes, so it'd be September for we'd dig those. That was always in conjunction with a potato grower, a fella who came up here out of southern Idaho, and he actually was a spud grower. He was a Japanese fella, real good farmer. But he had the equipment, and we furnished the irrigation equipment and the irrigation labor. And we always tied it down with a cover crop after it was done, after the spuds were done, to keep them from blowing.
Then where did those potatoes go?
Well, 99% of those would end up with a processor who would mostly would process them. A few of them would go into a fresh market, depending upon who they were going to. The first crop was entirely not contract at all. That was right in the days when people like J.R. Simplot and Carnation were getting all the contract potatoes they could get. About 12 or 14 potato processes, all the way from fresh fries to potato flakes to make out of those fresh potatoes. One crop we sold to McDonald's for French fries. They bought. They were stored. They were always stored in sheds right out here. And 2 years in a row, McDonald's bought all of our potatoes.
So, on your potatoes, then, are you saying that you might not know who was going to buy those potatoes when they were harvested?
That's right. That first year, we had no contract with anybody.
So you stored these potatoes? So you stored these potatoes until they were bought?
No.
And then you said 1 or 2 years in a row, McDonald's bought them?
In fact, that that, I think it was the second year that McDonald's bought the whole run. And then that must have been the next year after that. They bought the whole crop again, so we didn't have to contract them, but like the fourth year and the fifth year, we had a contract with Carnation, and then another contract with JR.
Was it to your advantage to have a contract rather than the open market?
About the only advantage was an assurance that probably you were going to be able to recover your expenses with that contract. They wrote those contracts for, supposedly a reasonable profit. But
that was according to them, not you.
Yeah.
Okay, so how about the grass seed? Now, first of all, I'm unfamiliar with this. I didn't know that grass was grown and harvested. So let's talk about that first a little bit. Well, what's that about?
And harvested.
I mean, what goes on with grass seed? I don't understand it as a crop. What does that mean?
Okay. I grew two different families of grass seeds. One of them were the bluegrasses, and the others were the fescue. You know, they're an entirely different looking grass.
Yeah.
There's another category that are used for pastures all over the world, really. The markets are all over the world. And the bluegrasses are primarily turf grasses. Golf courses, football fields, whatever. The fescues are also just another turf grass. They grow differently, but they're still a turf grass. And all the other grasses are a pasture grass or a mixture with alfalfa. There's big seed companies which actually are warehousers, holders of the stock of a year's crop, and they may clean it, get test germination, purity, and then package it. They may blend it, you know, blend different turf grasses together. They may blend annual. The ones I named are perennials, but there's also annual grasses, too, turf grasses. And they may put those into blends, sell them at a nursery in 1 pound bags, or they may sell them for planting 300 acres of pasture, and that would be in a 90 pound bag.
So how do you just grow grass? How do you get the seeds? Is that what you're harvesting, or the seeds from the grass?
All you get is that little seed out of that grass plant. The whole thing changed, the method of harvesting changed drastically in about 1950. Before 1950, they had the binders, And they date back to about the turn of the century, where they were cut off the ground, rolled up into a bundle, and tied. So you know what a binder is, what the binders are.
No, I don't.
Well, all the wheat,
but that's,
well, that reservation was harvested that way, mm-hmm. up until, well, over there in the big wheat areas, it was actually during the Depression, in the late 20s is when the combine finally took over from the binders. But anyhow, the grass seed was bowed, and then it was, they were fed, the bundles were fed into a stationary combine. A combine that was...
It didn't move around?
It did not go
okay.
around the field.
Okay.
It set in one spot, the bundles were pitched into it.
Mm.
The straw was all blown into to one pile. Then the self-propelled combine came along during the in the 30s, whereby you know, the header is always ahead of the separator, so it does not drop any of the ground down. So they started harvesting grass seed the very same way. They had to let it get more mature so that the seed would fall out of the grass bed. Whereas with the binder, it had to be cut greener, but still mature seed to keep that seed from shattering. The combine elevated it into a bunker. It was ordered into a truck to take it to a warehouse to, you know, store it.
And is that how they do that now?
Yeah, that's
this
exactly
is the
how they do it now.
This is the modern way of doing that
yep.
now.
Yep.
Okay, so we've covered the potatoes and we covered the grass. I know about wheat, and I've gotten wheat harvest from a lot of both. Now, let's talk about this for a minute. Did you say that your father or your parents were doing this harvesting without machinery when they first took it on?
To this extent, they were doing it with horses.
Yeah.
They did have a mowing machine that would cut it off. They didn't. Before the mowing machine, he used to have to take a scythe.
Yeah.
You know, to cut it off
yeah.
from the ground.
So were they part of some of these collective areas around the county that used to come and work neighbor to neighbor harvesting the wheat? And things like that, with like the threshing machines and things that people didn't own. Were they part of some of this?
Those stationary combines.
Yeah.
That was a cooperative effort. They had, harvest days.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, every farmer did not have a stationary, but they would, somebody did. And they get their own crop taken care of, and they move to a neighbor, and the neighbors would all follow it around.
Were you part of this? Do you remember any of this, or was this done?
Yes, it was done, except I was too little to.
Okay.
This is when I was like, seven or 8 years old.
Uh-huh.
But my dad did. He used to regularly work for another farmer on the stationery right out here on the sand ridge, and that farmer also owned a place here on Hunter Lane. Bill Moss was his name, and Dad would always help. And Dad, well, he bought a team from Bill of horses, and that's the way he paid for it, was for that team, or at least part of the money to, you know, for paying for the team. He just worked out.
So it was a real cooperative effort.
Oh, yeah.
With your neighbors as well.
Sure was. Sure was.
Let's talk.
And after that, when the machine age came in, which was, really, really got into high gear after World War II, by then it was much less of a cooperative thing. Very, very much less. I always put up a lot of hay for Willie, but that was a share thing. This was in addition to these other things that I had going, was putting up the hay that Willie grew, and he had a few head of cattle, and he wanted enough hay for his consumption, and I could use it for mine. So, but I harvested all of the hay. It was usually had about 80 acres of hay. Alfalfa hay.
Let's talk about cattle then, cattle in general. Let's talk about the hogs first. What did that involve? How do you do that?
Well, they were not grown in confinement. They could get inside of that barn to feeding stanchions, but they weren't on a concrete floor for their whole life. Dad had probably a couple of acres fenced out there for those hogs, and they got water there. And their favorite old mud holes.
Did you buy hogs or did you raise the young as they were born?
He had, he usually had four or five sows, and he would raise his own from the little pigs, through and would fatten them to about. In those days, they used to hit about 225 pounds for a hog that was ready to butcher.
And how long would that take?
They could get them up to there in 6 months.
From birth?